broadcasting around the world.
Around the world.
You're listening to the Mike Drop Club, hosted by Douglas Hamandiche. Message received.
Message received.
You do not need to know what you need.
What you need.
Just engage with the podcast feed.
Just engage with the podcast feed.
Providing weekly insights into cool stuff we've read, saw, did, or heard about what made us say, wow, eureka, damn, nothing is off limits. If it motivates and inspires you to reach your goals, then it shall be discussed. Featuring guest interviews from high performers and people of influence, and weekly awards for the best mic drop moment. This podcast is guaranteed to leave you pumped up for the week ahead. Don't just live life, make life boom.
How you guys doing out there? We have another one. Today is not your ordinary day. I have to put my testosterone to the side. Yeah? I'm here, I'm blessed. I've been fortunate enough to get an interview with the one and only Paula Moore. Now, for those of you who are not in the know, Paula Moore is not your average woman. That's what I was saying before in terms of lowering my testosterone on this one. This is not one whereby I'm going to go there with my male gravitas. This is one where I take the back seat to womanhood here, right? So, Paula Moore, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Fantastic, fantastic. And just to set the scene, Paula Moore, she's a group fashion director, okay? And she's principally in charge of six publications, okay? One of which, these are actually Woman and Home, Woman's Own, Woman's World, yeah? Chat, Feel Good, and there's one I'm missing from there.
Yeah, Woman. So,
and Woman.
So it's all the women's weeklies and the monthly Woman and Home.
Fantastic. So in terms of this show here, as you can see from the theme, how it's starting off already, this is heavily going to be focused on ensuring that those of you listening out there who are females have your chance to hear insightful knowledge from a woman that's actually doing it and is successful in her role. Okay, there's been a lot of conversations in the media, particularly around gender equality, diversity, all of these things. So we want to have a positive conversation in the sense of things that you can achieve as an individual, and in this case, Paula Moore's story. I want to know a lot more about Paula, and I really want to find out what is inside her head that keeps her focused. What is her secret sauce in terms of managing stress? And, you know, as we know in the corporate world, it's snakes and ladders. We see people rise, we see people fall. What has kept you on an even keel? And how did you get there in the first place? So right off the bat, Paula, again, thank you very much. I am honored to be in your beautiful house, in your fantastic kitchen. For those who can't be here and see it, there's a reason why she edits certain magazines, right? In terms of the home material design, is because she also knows how to do it for real. Her kitchen extension is fantastic, people. So I applaud you on that one.
Okay.
Paula, how you been? How's it going? It's 2020.
Yeah.
How are things looking for you?
Yeah. So 2020 started off well. I'm very busy as usual. Luckily had 2 weeks off for Christmas, but going back into it like full swing.
Yeah.
So
full swing. So in terms of your background, how did you get into this industry that is fashion, design, interior? How did that morph into something cohesive to say, this is what I want to do?
Well, it all started when I was younger. I loved magazines and I used to read a lot. I used to read lots of books and things as well. And I wrote off to magazines for work experience. And that's how I got my foot through the door. So it was back in the day. This was talking about in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I was actually sending a stamped addressed envelope with a letter requesting that I could come in and work for free, and if anyone would want my services.
Wow.
Best magazine actually replied and they asked me to come in. So I went, I was so excited. And I literally went into the cupboard to sort out the clothes for them. It was, I was there, I was just in the cupboard all day, and they actually forgot about me because I was so quiet, just getting on with it. At the end of the day, they felt really bad because I hadn't had the lunch break or anything. But I was like just so excited to be there and doing what I do.
And how old are you at the time?
I was 18, so I just finished my A-levels.
Yeah.
Lots of my friends were applying to uni to do and that. So this was within the school holidays. Mm-hmm. So I was going to go to university to do a fashion degree anyway. But I thought in between then, let's like try and get some experience beforehand.
Now that's excellent. And for anybody who's thinking, is it worth now in the digital age in writing those letters, stamped, addressed, envelopes, all that kind of stuff, where you can send an email. What's your views around that?
I think emails are good, but letters, why not send a letter, a covering letter, and make it personal to the person.
Yeah.
It's not like to whom it may concern. Do your research beforehand. I knew who I was writing to. I had the magazines. I had the editor's name. To make it a bit personal. It shows that you've done your research and
I think that's timely because I'd done the show 2 days ago just regarding your CV and how we need to try and move away from CVs that read very generic, just a list of skills. It should read like the narrative of your life.
Yeah, and also I think a CV should be tailored to every job that you apply for. Everyone wants different skills. They want to see different things.
Yeah.
So make it personal.
Yeah. So at this young age, when you got your friends wanting to pursue, going to university, summer holidays.
Yeah.
And this is the era whereby there were loads of magazines. I got four sisters, so I can tell you that just 17,
just 17.
Smash It.
Smash It. Jackie.
You know
My Guy.
I read all of those as a dude. You know, my dad wanted me to read novels and all this stuff, but these were lying around my sister's rooms all the time, and I found them insightful.
Yeah.
To be honest, they were well crafted. I feel we've lost some of those things.
Yeah,
now.
I mean, it's a different era now. People are on their phones all the time. It's all about Instagram and things like that. So unfortunately, people aren't buying magazines as much as they used to.
Yeah. So, but you were prepared as an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
To work for free, effectively. Where'd that come from?
Well, I think, my parents are Jamaican. They came over to the UK as a young teen, so finished their schooling here. You're not come from, very wealthy backgrounds or anything. And I think I get my work ethic from them. Both my parents work really, really hard. My mum's taken early retirement, but my dad still works. He's, nearly 70. They've always worked really hard and just instilled in me that, as a young black girl or, black person, black boy as well, you just always have to work hard and do that bit extra.
Yeah.
So, you've always got to be better than the next person. And I think that's even true to this day. Yeah, things have moved on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I've always got to make sure I do my best.
Yes, and that's a powerful lesson there. And I can mirror that. I was taught not to work a little bit harder. I was told I have to work double.
Yeah.
Treble. Just either way, you can't go to bed knowing you've just done your regular.
No.
There's something extra. So, but still, in the sense of putting yourself out there, the younger you, the pre-18 you, right? Were you this innovative in terms of your approach to find employment?
Yeah, I mean, I always had Saturday jobs. I think from the age of 11, I was delivering newspapers. I think I used to get 1p per paper. And the thing is, in those days, I was my parents' influence and support. I remember my mum used to come and help me because she thought I was too young to be walking the streets with a little shopping trolley, putting the free newspapers in people's stores.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And, because I used to earn £1.12 a week. But it was my £1.12.
Most definitely. It was your £1.12.
To do with what I wanted. Yeah.
Exactly. And you've earned it.
Yes.
I too done that.
Yeah.
How amazing is that? And I remember when you get to blocks of flats.
I remember talking about it years later and people were shocked. They're like, you actually delivered every paper.
Yeah.
Most people were dumping them by the canal. And I was I didn't even think to do that because they were paying me to do a job and I would do the job.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to take the easy route out, which maybe I should have done sometimes when it was raining and snowing. But no, it's like you're getting paid to do a job, so you do it properly.
Most definitely. And I think that experience, the benefits of doing that, although it might be a humbling experience, and I recall a few instances where I met my friends while delivering these things, and they too said to me, just dump him in the locker, bro.
Yeah.
No one's going to know.
Yeah.
I said, nope, I've started, so I'll finish.
Yeah.
And what that gave me, and I'm not sure you can answer for yourself, was a sense of confidence that I can knock on anyone's door. Because sometimes I'll put a leaflet through, either get my hand ripped off, put a dog on the other side. But I was terrified. Yeah. Every single house where I delivered those leaflets, every single one, without a doubt, I was terrified.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, as the latch comes down, I freeze.
And I think actually on the flip side of that, there were some of my friends who, like in the summer holidays, would knock on people's door and offer to wash cars and things.
Yeah.
My parents wouldn't allow me to do that. And I thought they were being really unfair. Mm. But looking back on it, it said as a young black kid, and I grew up in Wembley, and back in the day, we were the only black people on the whole road. So my mum and dad wanted to have the pride that I wasn't going to be knocking, sort of asking people to give me money, even though I was providing them a service. It's like I could, you know, make money my own way by doing something, but not by knocking and asking for it. So I think, you know, maybe it's a Jamaican parent thing, but, you know, I get it. I get why they, went comfortable with me doing that.
Excellent. And those are real skills. Those are things that are missing in society, whereby people might feel pride that kind of kicks in. I can't do that.
Yeah.
And so as you're scribing these letters, and are you praying? Are you wishing for a successful outcome? What's your mindset like? Are you saying, I'm going to post a letter out and I expect to hear feedback within?
Well, I think back then I must have sent, say 30 letters. And I was like, well, out of 30, surely some people will want me.
Pause. These are what we call mic drop moments, right? Now, you got to understand that we're going back in the day, yeah? So was this on typewriter or handwritten?
Oh, no, this is a typewriter.
This is a typewriter,
with
with Tippex and carriage return, right? So these are not easy things to do, right? Not like your word and all that kind of stuff that you got now going on. So you're talking about crafting 30. No spell check, Tippex job, yeah? As an 18-year-old,
no photocopying.
None of that. That deserves what I call a mic drop moment, okay? So that is the first one. In terms of your effort, you're going to have to put in effort in life to get any results. Mm. And so if you're talking about pushing out 30 and you got feedback from how many? One. So one in 30. Now, let me ask you guys out there as you're listening to this. Would you send out 30 handcrafted covering letters via email that you've proofread, that you pushed through Grammarly, that you double-checked? Would you even do that now for any job? Or are you then going through straight agency and expecting the agency to represent your best interests and wondering why you're not really successful? Please, there's lessons in here. The reason why we've got Paula here to discuss these things with you guys is because she has done it. 30 letters for starters off to get one feedback. Yeah.
And unpaid work.
Oh my God. You see, this whole notion of monetary remuneration, being remunerated for your efforts, right? Again, it's something that people need to really just chill and ask yourself, how much are you worth? Right now, how much are you worth? Like, some people are not looking to get employed or struggling to find employment because somehow they've got this delusional grandeur that I'm only worth £500 a day or whatever the case may be, right? But there's something in humbling yourself and knowing that at this present stage in my life, I don't know enough to command that fee.
Yeah.
But what I'll give you back is my passion. Yeah. Is my time and my effort, okay? And if you're doing that, the money will come later on and you're learning. Yeah. So though you weren't getting paid money, what did you get yourself out of those experiences?
I mean, I'd never been into that environment before. So before applying to work for magazines, I'd actually won a competition. And I remember receiving a letter from the editor to tell me I'd won.
Excellent.
And I was probably about 9 years old and I won a watch. But the letter that I've received from the editor, which I still got to this day, was just something to me. It's like, oh my God, she's the editor of a magazine and she knows who I am. She's written to me.
Yeah.
And that is something that inspired me to want to work for magazines because it seemed something you used to buy in a shop. But this is, it's real people behind those pages. And I thought, oh, I could do that. You know, I would love to be in that environment. Mm-hmm. So doing the work experience, going into that environment, and it was, you know, the flash offices and all these women really well-dressed, and it just was that buzz, and you're walking in, you know, it's like walking into a movie set or something.
Oh, brilliant. So how were you received?
They were all lovely. The girls there, I mean, some of them who I still speak to this mm-hmm. day, and I was there, they booked me for 2 weeks, but I said, I went in, I was early, I stayed late, I did whatever was asked for me, and they could see that passion, so they kept me on for a bit longer, and then they started paying me.
Brilliant.
Which
brilliant.
Is there, and then they actually put me forward for a full-time fashion assistant job,
wow.
which I got 6 weeks later.
Excellent. That is superb, and that's coming from first humbling yourself, having that work ethic.
Yeah.
As your DNA, this is something that you're going to do, and being positive.
Yeah,
you know, cannot be demanding in these sorts of environments, particularly in these creative spaces. You've got to demonstrate passion.
You are so much more. MikeDropClub.com. Make life boom.
Yeah. So Paula, as you are going on this journey, you got this idea, this wish, this aspiration to go into the fashion industry. So at some point you would have had to have a conversation with your parents.
Yes. And as I said, Jamaican parents. So my dad was like, what? You want to be a what? And I was like, a stylist. And he's like, what's that? And I said, I'm going to get paid to dress people.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, why can't they dress themselves? And he's like, okay. But he's like, because I did quite well in school, so I had good grades and things. So he like had aspirations of me being a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. So it did take him a while to sort of understand what I was doing.
Yeah.
And then I started having my picture in the magazine or getting people involved, like coming on photo shoots. We do like my auntie's been in loads of photo shoots. So if you ever need a real woman, like, she'll do that.
Sure.
So once he saw that, then he understood, and now he's really proud.
Sure. And to push through that, you've done an excellent beginning in how it's ended up. It's fantastic. Mm. But the journey now, your father has expressed reservations, should I say, about this industry that he doesn't know a lot about.
No, not
and at the time, you too don't know a lot about.
Yeah.
But that's something that you want to do.
Yeah.
And I can see in you that all the professions that your dad would have had ideas or aspirations for you to do, you could do them quite easily. Yeah. There's a lot of passion, a lot of talent in you. I can just see it. But you want to go on your own journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had the fortitude, the bravery to express it to your parents. A lot of young people, I ask them, when I do coaching exercises with them, and I say, what do you want to be? The first thing that comes up, I know in my back of mind, it's not really what they want to be.
Yeah.
They're doing it's peer pressure, parents' pressure.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
If I hang around long enough with the young people, they end up saying all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and then the butt comes in.
Yeah.
And it's normally a big butt.
Yeah.
I can't do it because my parents want me to become a doctor, a lawyer. And
I think it's because we know how much our parents sacrifice for us. So as I said, you know, I know my parents work really, really hard and, you know, to give me everything and give me and my brother everything that we've had. And, you know, my dad's worked 12-hour, 14-hour days, you know, and it was a struggle for them. And so you want to repay them in some way by you know, making them proud and doing something that they perceive to be like a good job.
Yeah.
So, but
And this makes us unique in terms of anyone that's come to the UK, first generation, second generation. You have this sense of responsibility and honouring those who came before us, who are truly pioneers. Because let's think about it. When we see the Windrush generation or anyone coming, economic migrants coming in, young people right now have no idea in terms of what it must have been like in those days to leave your country whereby you don't know where you're going.
No.
It's not like here now where you got instant news that you can see.
Yeah.
A lot of them never understood the dynamics of leaving a tropical island.
Yeah, coming to the cold.
To the cold.
And they all lived in one room. So it was all the fact, my grandparents, my mom, the sisters,
there you go.
All aunties. Yeah, they all,
So it's a burden. It's a burden on the next generation.
Yeah, I want to make them proud and I know how much they sacrifice.
So did you have that consciously in your back of your mind when you're now in the profession? Say, do you know what? Because of this sacrifice that my parents done, I have to see this through.
I think not just in this profession, I think it would be whatever I did. Yeah. And I think it is just something that's instilled in us to be, yeah, just to work really hard and to be the best that we can at all times.
Yeah, because certainly yeah. To a parent, parents have their own friends, yeah. their own networks that we call uncles.
And yes, uncles, yeah, aunties and
yeah.
uncles.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So he would have to have a conversation with your uncles, that Paula, she wants to become a stylist. Yeah. and that is where he's going to be struggling,
yeah.
right? So there's something about that as well in terms of like what we do to articulate our visions yeah. to our parents. And the good thing that I've heard, lots of good things I've heard coming from you today, but a few excellent, real salient points were doing your due diligence, doing your research based yeah. in anything you want to do. So you would have been questioned by your father. Yes, and having something to rebut yeah. back would have been giving you some sort of confidence yeah. that, you know what, this is not something I'm doing on the yeah. whim. This is something I really want to yeah. do. And being pressurized like that, I would say is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because you need something to bounce back off, yeah. to double check yeah. and give you a sanity check. Am I doing the right thing?
Yeah,
this is my journey.
Yeah.
You know, although we come from our parents that yeah. we have our own journey. You know, so no, that's an excellent narrative. But then the struggles along the way, were you able to share them with your father?
Not really. I think I would sort of deal with them within myself and deal with all the struggles I had on my own.
Yeah. So I can see you. The viewers can't see you, but I can see you. I can see this passion. Yeah, yeah, you're just vibrating positive mm-hmm. energy. What do you do to protect yourself around people that have energy levels that will sap yours or have different mindset? What yeah. do you do to keep
yourself? I mean, it is hard sometimes. And then sometimes, yeah, you know, if there's a lot of negativity, it's hard to, yeah, you know, still stay strong and positive. I am always an advocate of sometimes just walking away from situations. So if I'm in the office and everything's getting a bit stressful, it's all getting a bit too much, just take yourself away, like go outside, have a walk, and then put everything into
perspective.
Yeah, you know, I work in fashion. I'm not saving lives. If the belt that I wanted hasn't turned up, it's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. And you've got to think of the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that in the full.
So fashion again is one whereby when you, our generation, should I say, the biggest fashion icon I would say is Naomi Campbell.
Yeah.
You correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows who she is.
I lay claim to Naomi Campbell because again, she's from South London and all that kind of stuff. But then it felt like it's such a different world.
Yeah.
It's just. She was done. She done music video of Michael Jackson, and so I thought this woman is. And I was doing work in IT engineering at the time, and I was thinking, how could you even get to that stage?
Yeah.
You know, and they would tell stories about how models are just discovered walking on the tube.
Oh yeah, I think she was discovered in Primark.
In Primark.
Shopping on
it.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew? For Primark can lead to such opportunity, but it does. So the fashion industry, as it was then, in terms of representation for people of color, women, would you say, what's your view on that? Is it improving?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, back in the day, you know, doing model castings, and you would only get white models. And so now, and then I'll be like, oh, actually, you know, I can use girls from different ethnic backgrounds. Mm. And they'd be like, oh, sorry, we don't have any available. Mm. So for me as a black woman, working in an environment where it was very white, it did affect me in a way that I needed to see progress, but there wasn't as much I could do if the girls aren't there. So if you're approaching the agencies and they don't have those girls available, but now, luckily, there is more sort of a mix. And also, it's not just the skin colour. It's about all sizes as well. Because, I mean, a model doesn't have to be a size 8. So, you know, it's about, you know, empowering women of colour and size.
Okay. And are they looking for stereotypical type features? Because I've seen, I can't name them. You have to forgive me with that one. Or maybe I should have done a bit more research in terms of these models. But there was a time whereby certain features were brought to the fore in terms of how dark you have to be, yeah. you know, and then they push that as yeah. as represent maybe the mean, or is it done to say shock? Is it done to?
No, I think there was a time when maybe it would have been done to shock, but now I think it is just more exclusivity, and everyone knows it's the way forward, and they're sort of recognizing that. But it's great to see big stores like say M&S who are having black women in the campaign, but it's not like, you know, just trying to tick a box. I think they're beautiful black women.
Sure.
So, and
sure.
then they might use someone who is a size 18, but it's not like, oh, this is a curve model or a plus size. It's just a beautiful woman who's bigger than the next model. So sure. I think things are changing a lot and changing for the better. And, it's taking its time.
Yeah. And you presided over some of those things that yeah. suggest that you exercise your influence.
Yeah. I mean, you can, you know, like baby steps, but I can do as much as I can. But if I'm in a position to book a model, I will, yeah, try and use diversity as much as I can.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I'll be the product as well of diversity in the sense of the just tick box numbers. Yeah. I've had roles whereby I felt that I'm only in that role because yeah. of my youth, which I can't control, you know. Yeah. That tokenism. Yeah. So when we talk about diversity, and I'm quite happy, I'm actually very happy indeed just to hear from you that things are improving. In sense yeah. of,
I mean, there's still a long way to go, but things are improving. So I've been in the industry almost 30 years now, so I've seen a big difference. And yeah.
Yeah. I'm a fan of Oswald Boateng.
Yeah.
Yeah, his suits. And in terms of black fashion moguls, are there any UK-based? You know, growing up in my culture was a lot of influenced by the hip hop culture from overseas. So therefore, you know, Carl Kanai, you know, Sean Jean, and those type of clothing I used to wear. But there was some unique UK trends.
Yeah.
You know, like rolling up your.
Rolling up your jeans, one leg.
Yeah, and exposing your Burlington socks, you know, your checkered Burlington socks. So I done all of that.
Yeah.
But there was no real ownership of it. It was almost like a street type trend. But is there any way that, or are there any black fashion houses that are coming up from the UK that's piqued your radar?
Not really in that sense. I suppose there's a lot of collaborations. And so rather than saying like a black fashion house, it might be like say great black fashion designers,
yeah.
Like Off-White and things like that. But they're there, but I don't think it's sort of just like, is it as a known as a black fashion house type
thing. Sure. It's maybe the collaborative type approach. Because the music scene as well is becoming a lot more polished. Yeah. You know, you've got grime, you've got garage now, garage before grime, and then grime has gone to something else. But in the sense of, does that, the music industry, you know, the urbanization of the music industry, does it also follow the fashion industry?
And I think now with everything, everyone's having access to so much more. So like this Instagram, this YouTube, things like that. So, you know, and we have access to everything 24 hours. So that's a lot more influential of what the trends are going to be and what people are doing.
Okay. And back to the numbers in terms of your publications, of which there's six. I'm not going to go in details about the public, but they do two distinct things I'm seeing anyway. There's the home side of things.
Yeah.
There's a woman's side of things. What is the clear distinction between the two, and how are you bridging the gap in terms of your core thing is the fashion side?
Yeah, so I also oversee fashion pages.
Yeah, so in the Woman's Own,
yeah.
My mum was a big fan of the Woman's Own. I'm not too sure now. Is it still, what's your numbers like in terms of publication? How many numbers are you actually shipping?
I mean, luckily the magazines that I work on, they're for the older ladies, so they are still selling really well. So I think it's a younger one. So like we recently lost Marie Claire magazine.
Okay.
So that's no longer in print. It's online. Magazines, the ones that suffer are the young ones, like Look magazine, which is a great women's girls like teenage weekly, and that's no longer being published.
Yeah, so
but with our titles, because it's the older lady, like Women's Weekly, the average age is probably say 65. So they're still religiously buying magazines or have it on subscription and getting it on every week.
So the content now, is it changing with the times?
Yeah, I think it has to. So, I mean, like say Women's Weekly, for example, you still have like your knitting patterns and things like that. Mm. But then for fashion, we might focus on a price point. Mm. You know, not everyone's got loads of disposable income anymore.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's more of a buy well, buy less feature.
Sure.
So investment pieces. Or fashion for different shapes and sizes. So yeah, so we're sort of more focused. So it's not just like, hey, red's a trend this week. It's more focused on, you know, different themes.
Yep. And do you lean heavily on celebrities in terms of the news feeds?
So they are sort of quite celebrity-led based magazines, but for the fashion side of it, no. It's just like, you know, what's being produced on the high street. But I think another new thing that's quite good, it's a sustainability side of things. And I think the high street's really catching on and everyone's trying to do their bit for the environment and think about how they're processing things and how things are made.
Sure. So you're actually doing a big piece of work in terms of source, the materials that you use in the fashion industry. Yeah? You're now more consciously aware in terms of where those materials are being sourced for. So what is the alternatives? For example, I saw a clip the other day about hangers.
It was random.
I just saw hangers everywhere.
Yeah, because it's the plastic. So it's like, you know, back in the day, there were more wooden hangers and the metal ones and things like that. It's just about, you know, being able to reuse things, all that side of it, really.
Sure. And in the fashion industry, I guess the challenge is whereby you've got seasons.
Yeah.
And if you're top end fashion, you might not wear last season's spring attire, right?
Yeah.
How are they actually pushing you to continue wearing that?
I think now it's more like, as you said, like maybe an investment piece. So a coat you bought last year, it's not saying you just wear it one season and that's it.
Mm.
Maybe, and it's like how you wear it. So you might have bought a camel coat last year. This year, buy a brown belt to put around it.
Okay.
So it's just like, it's how you wear it and just to make it a bit different and accessorize differently and just wear things in different ways.
Yeah, I thought I could testify to that as well, because no matter how many jeans I have, no matter how many, I only wear three.
Right. Okay.
No matter how many I have.
Okay.
I've got over 10 jeans. Okay. Quite a few that I've never ever worn. But I've got my go-to three.
Right.
No matter how many blazers I have, I've got my go-to three.
Right. So what else we use now as well? So if you like, so fast fashion is like things like, you know, just buy once and like get rid of. But, you know, you can always give to charity shops so other people can benefit from things that you don't wear anymore.
Sure.
Or eBay to buy sort of secondhand things and or sell stuff as well. So they've got another life. If you don't want them, you know, you're passing it on.
Exactly. And I think that is definitely something that is deeply in our culture.
Yeah.
Whereby one man's junk is another man's treasure. Don't throw away that.
Someone else can make
use of it.
Yeah.
As you're now in the industry, you've gone to the stage now, you've got a permanent job.
Yeah.
Is that where you've stayed since writing that letter?
Oh, no. So
what was the journey like?
After being at work experience and I've got became fashion assistant after 6 weeks, getting paid, which was the dream. By the age of 21, I was made a fashion editor.
Fashion editor at the age of 21. And this was in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Which magazine was that?
It was Catch magazine. No longer there. It was the company DC Thompson.
Okay.
Who do like the Beano, Dandy.
Okay, okay,
thing.
Okay.
So I was on Fleet Street.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Beano and Dandy. I remember. Oh my God, is the Beano, I'm sure the Beano is still going.
So DC Thompson, the Scottish-based publishers, they're still doing really well.
Still going. Fleet Street.
Yeah, I was on Fleet Street.
Age 21.
21.
What was that like? What did that look like? You know, when you come out of work first. Describe the scenario. Good.
And also because the fashion team were in London, but everyone else was based up in Edinburgh. And it was weird, you know, there I am going to this office full of men in suits and little old me from Wembley.
Oh,
it was a strange experience, but I loved it.
How were you feeling there? Did you ever have a bout to what they call imposter syndrome, like I don't deserve to be here.
Sometimes I think that's sort of a natural sort of, and you know, a confidence thing as well. But I just thought, if I don't go and do my best, they can replace me. So you just got to go in and like sort of fake it until you make it, and just go in there with the confidence that you know what you're doing, and you do it. You know, we all make mistakes, but you've got to learn from those mistakes.
Sure,
that's the main thing.
Were there any big ones for you? Like, you know that yourself, I do need to go that way.
Yeah. I think what I've learned along the way is you've just got to be prepared. I mean, if you've got a big shoot, and that's mean, like if I go away on a trip, the company are investing a lot of money for a shoot. It could be thousands, you know, lots and lots of money. So I've got to make sure everything's organized, you know, check like flights and accommodation, and just make sure, you know, everyone knows what they're doing, and just being prepared. You can't go out and have a big night out and turn up the next day feeling a bit sorry for yourself.
That's not the life.
Okay. I can't do that.
Epic film.
So it's just, to make sure.
As an editor, what do you do as an editor? Like, what are the primary tasks of an editor?
All right. So with my role, so it's a fashion director across the six titles.
Yeah.
But every day is different. I mean, it's like I've got a team of seven. So okay. I couldn't do the job without the girls.
There you go. Teamwork.
It is all about teamwork. We all work really hard to achieve what we have to do.
So the management of the... Now, the type of management skills that you have to lead the team as chief editor is what's your management technique?
I think I'm fair but firm.
Yeah.
I want the girls to be able to
firm.
You know, if there's a problem, let's discuss it and sort it out straight away. But I think, you know, I would like to be think they would sound very approachable, and we get on with it and reward when reward is due.
Sure.
And like, you know, I'm always, you know, please and thank yous. It doesn't cost anything to be polite. And I think that goes a long way. I think appreciating for what people do.
Did you find a way of mastering how to manage battles in the corporate world, which I can imagine there are lots of mini battles?
I think my way is to always be professional about it and to choose which battles that you want to take further and to escalate. You know, there's always things that people are going to say and do that you don't agree with, or, you know, but, you know, you're not going to start rearing up and shouting and doing all that, because it's, you know, that's not going to get you anywhere. So just, and, you know, if someone says something you don't agree with, just respectfully tell them that and like have a conversation about it. Sometimes it can be just ignorance or, you know, not really thinking. But there are ways to deal with situations, and I think that's what I've learned.
Any practical advice for all those infamous email battles?
Email battles, stop them straight away. Just say, have you got 5 minutes? Can we go and grab a coffee and just talk about it?
Yes.
Yeah, face to face is always so much easier.
There you go.
And things, you know, in an email, you might try to be, you know, it doesn't come across well, and no capitals. Like you're shouting, it's always best face-to-face to discuss it.
Yeah, I think we've lost a lot through emails, having that direct communication. I think this also helped, this probably your background, going back to delivering those leaflets, maybe seeing people that you don't know open the door and say, I don't want that. Gives you confidence to say, do you know what, actually, let's talk face-to-face.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of keyboard warriors out there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and being able to take it to there comes from a place that is just born out of you.
And also, I always think, like, tomorrow's another day. So you might go have, like, something that's happened in the work, and you're just feeling it, and you go home feeling really angry or whatever. You know, put that by, like, leave it behind, and the next day just get up and do your thing. There's no point holding on to, like, grudges and things like that. I think life's too short. So,
yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, just, you know, be true to yourself. I want to make sure that the girls who work in the team with me, I hope they would say that I know I appreciate everything that they do.
Brilliant, because, again, a lot of people feel sometimes that they're not valued, they're not acknowledged. Yeah. And this is sometimes I've heard women speak about that they feel invisible at work.
Yeah.
So now, as in your work environment, is it more female-led now?
Yeah, it's very female-led, which is really good. I think the fashion and magazine worlds, especially on the women's titles, have always been very female-led environments, which is, you know, quite unknown in other industries. But yeah, for the fashion and magazine world, it is all very female-based things.
So the men in the industry, what do they tend to do?
There's a few men like in the art department. We do have a few editors that are men as well. There is a few, but like I'm just sort of looking around the office and so like we don't have any men who work in beauty. We don't have men who work in the health team. We don't have men who work in the features department either.
Oh, wow.
But I suppose we are writing about women's issues and like the menopause and this, that and the other. So it is a very female environment.
Yeah. And I think that that's important for you to stipulate that certain environments should warrant people that have experience in it to add that value. Yeah. So when you're interviewing, I'm assuming you interviewed some of these six or all of the six people that work underneath you or with you.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what core skills, what's your interview skills like?
I think, you know, we've got to have a real can-do attitude. So when anyone that's interviewed in the past, they come in. And again, I think to do their research, because we work on so many different magazines, if they come in and they're not quite sure which mag it is and that stuff like that, it's like, well, it doesn't take long to actually find out that information before sitting in front of me.
Sure.
So again, that would be like a little cross. Like, I normally give people three chances. But, you know, you can make a mistake. People are nervous. Okay. They might get things wrong. Fine. You know, you can ask lots of questions. If, you know, I said I work, some of the magazines are weekly, some are monthly or a bi-monthly. That's information you should know.
Yeah.
That's sort
exactly.
of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The, so these things are elementary within the sphere of your job, really. Yeah. So three strikes and you're out, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, it's good. So when you're in the interview position now, you've got a candidate in front of you.
Yeah.
Is your mindset to look for a mini you? This is where they're getting
the government. Yeah, it's the best person for the job.
Yeah.
It always has to be, really. And someone who you know is going to fit in within the team that you already have. In the team, we have someone who's a really strong character, quite loud, and then someone who's quite more reserved. But that works. You know, you don't want everyone being the loud and, you know, and that sort of thing. But for my job, because it's very practical, so it's like doing photo shoots and compiling pages, and it's a very visual thing. Mm. So on an interview stage, so see how that goes, and then I would set them a task to do. So like go away, get a mood board together. What idea would you come say for the July issue? What would you do for those pages? And then that way you can see how they approach it and what they would do for that.
Okay, cool. So you'd be able to tease out, obviously thinking on the fly, how creative they are because that's the type of space. Yeah. Do you tend to have within the industry, and I'm speaking on behalf now, I'm championing the females that are introverted, and how do you think they perform in such tasks? Or do you have a way of?
Well, as I said, they might in the interviews and set like not be able to express themselves because they are like quite shy or nervous, whatever. Yeah. But then, if the written work that they're doing on their own, and then having to submit, so like the mood boards, the ideas, and everything, if that comes across and that's really good, that is half the job anyway. So
that is excellent because. There are people out there that want to get into the industry, you know, but then they may be closet fashion gurus and they end up doing their own, taking media into their own hands and doing their own blogging channels, all that kind of stuff. Because they felt that the fashion industry wasn't open enough for them to go into. Yeah. But it's also refreshing to hear that, no, there are people like you that if they can just get in front of, you know, that will be able to tease out those skills, whether or not they're extroverted and they're like, it's all about me, or they're introverted. It's a balance because, as you said, it's about being able to work within the team and how you fit in with that team structure. Because, you couldn't have a team full of extroverts, could you?
A team full of
extroverts.
Oh, no, it might be a bit annoying for everyone else in the office, but it has happened in the past.
Yeah. Okay, so now you've gone on this journey, so you're now a chief editor.
Yeah, so I was fashion editor for a while, and then Unfortunately, that magazine closed. Yes. So I think that's why, as I said, I've been in the industry a long time, so things come and go. Mm. So Catch Magazine, they folded that after a few years. So then I went freelance. So that was another sort of new experience for me, represented by an agency. So they have my portfolio. So they're like, say, right, this week you're going here, there and everywhere. Yeah. So you get your portfolio, get on the tube with your little A to Z.
Yeah.
And then go.
The A to Z.
And then go and see clients. So go and see prospective clients, show them your portfolio. And again, it's not in those situations, it's not just about what I can do. It's like, you know, will they book me because they want me to be on a shoot with them for the whole day? Do we gel in that way? Because it's not just about the styling side. It is a bit about the personality and the person that you are.
Yeah.
So,
you know, so going freelance, you feel more stretched.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you bring about more skills that you learn doing that.
You do that, and it's like, you know, I can walk into a room of five people, never met them before. You've got to sell yourself to them.
Wow.
And then they give you a brief, you go away, you've got to meet that brief, you're turning up on a shoot a week later, you know, a whole crew that you have got no control over, you're just employed to be there on the day to do your best, and then off and then doing something else. So you're only as good as your last job.
Brilliant. So, yeah. Brilliant. So there's something there about being able to sell yourself.
Yeah.
And now we're getting warmed up in that conversation. Yeah. So a lot of people struggle, quite frankly, in being able to put their best foot forward and represent their most authentic self in either in an interview situation or in what they call the, that was that exercise when they're in a lift. And they're going to do like a pitch in the lift type scenario whereby it's basically what that is, basically where they say to you, okay, imagine you're on a lift and somebody, elevator pitch typically, somebody of influence comes into that lift with you and it's going up a floor, up several floors. And the guy asks you, or the woman asks you, what do you do? And that's your moment to shine, right? That is your moment to shine. A lot of people yield. So as you, now you're talking about in the freelance environment, you have to sell yourself all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
So how do you go about doing that in terms of, do you, is it now so deeply at this stage in your career, was it so deeply ingrained what you do? The confidence levels are so high, you're peaking on everything. So straight away, boom. Or was it one whereby you had pre-rehearsed ways of carrying yourself, speaking? What was that like?
It was a bit like a pre-rehearsal, because if you think it's, you're meeting different people every day and you're basically saying the same thing.
Yeah.
So it is that sort of thing. So you know, you've got to go in and you've got to shine, maybe make them laugh or something. And just, you know, so when you've left that room, they remember you.
Yeah.
Because they might be seeing 10 stylists for the same job.
Yeah.
So it is a bit like, you know, you've only got like, say, 10 minutes to impress. So even if you're not feeling that great, you just sort of, you know, like take a deep breath, walk into that room, do your best, 10 minutes, that's all you've got. And it, you know, it'll be over. So yes, just sort
of
happen.
Did your nerves ever get the best of you in those moments?
Oh yeah. So there's a few times when you get a bit tongue tied with that. And then you could ask, oh, can I have a glass of water, please? And, you know, just take time to compose yourself. I'm not saying that every time I went in, I sort of killed it. I didn't always get the job. But then that's life. And,
that's life.
And then things that you don't do right, you just have to learn from that and move on. And don't take things personally. I think that's the main thing as well. So
you say that with a sense of sincerity. Yeah. You say, don't take things personally. Yeah. Can you tell me a time whereby you took something personally?
I think it's just comes with age. I mean, now that you're a bit older, you have that confidence. I remember years ago, I was on a job and someone's like, who are you wearing? And I'm like, what are they talking about? Who are you wearing? And I just sort of looked around and everyone was like wearing designer labels. And I was like, oh, I'm wearing Topshop. And you know, it was just like, and I sort of looked and the people I was working with, they're not my kind of people, but you know, it was fine. And again, I've like just felt a bit out of my depth. And I was like, do you know what? The fact that she was asking about what I'm wearing must mean she liked it. So twist it around and make it work for you. Because, yeah, I wasn't wearing a designer label. I can't afford designer labels. It's like, yeah, it was Topshop. But, you know, at that point, I was a bit like, oh, you know, didn't know, how to act and stuff. But just,
So you have this ability to switch the narrative.
Yeah.
And the way you perceive things.
Yeah. Rather than all thinking, oh, poor Paula.
Yeah.
She can't afford Prada.
we've been there before. Someone asked you a question. So how you interpret things? So you have a positive outlook on life at all times,
Actually, I do remember another one. I did save up really hard and bought a designer handbag. And good. I remember going in.
Now we're warming up.
And someone said to me, oh, is that a fake? And I was just like, why are you assuming it's a fake?
Where were you? And who was this miscreant?
It was actually my editor at the time of a magazine I was working on.
Oh.
Yeah. And she just assumed.
Epic fail. That editor, whoever you are, you get that. Why? Yeah. Why would you do that?
Yeah. Why?
Yeah. So you're grinning. But no, that's a very important lesson as well, just in the sense of authenticity, right? Yeah. Because within the fashion industry as well, it's one of the most aspirational type of environments to be in. Like, you wear this outfit, it's say Prada, or whatever the case may be. And to those who are not, who can't afford it, they aspire to wear it.
Yeah.
And for those who can afford it as if it's normal day, they treat it completely differently. They might even wear it, you know. We see within socially and economically deprived neighborhoods, young kids getting involved in violence, selling drugs and all sorts of bad activities just to get some of these stuff, whether it's a £150 pair of Nikes or a £250 Gucci belt, whatever the case would be.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind when you see these things? Yeah. How are you viewing that?
I think it's a shame because you don't need to be wearing labels to feel in any way. It's like, you know, I went to the gym earlier and I was putting on my trainers. So I was like, oh, actually, I've probably had these trainers about 20 years. Mm. Maybe do I need a new pair? And I was like, actually, I don't. I just, you don't need to have material things to make you feel a way or, you know, to make you feel better. And
Where does your confidence come from? To say that, to compared to somebody say in the city, and having the fake say Gucci bag, is a highlight
So I would think, like, you know, fake Gucci. Why not just have a nice bag? It doesn't. What's a label achieving? I wouldn't buy a fake. I'll just buy, if I can't afford the real thing, just buy a nice bag and you've got a nice bag.
Yeah,
you cut, it shouldn't be about labels.
You're cutting your cloth accordingly, right? And that allows you to then save. That allows you then to do other things. Yeah. So don't go broke trying to fit in.
No.
You know, if you can't, I think Jay-Z says something, you can't afford it twice. Don't buy it, you know. I'm a firm believer of that. Yeah. But equally so, confession time for me. Growing up in South London, I'm digressing because it's a conversation. Those things we aspired to, like in terms of fashion, all that kind of stuff, I didn't have them.
Yeah.
I had all of them.
Right.
All those ones I could find in the store, whether I was in Brixton going to Barron's or whether I was going to West End buying. But it was coming from a place whereby I too, like you, had the work ethic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would work for those things. Yeah. My dad and mom would look at me like, you're so stupid.
Yeah.
You know?
But you weren't getting it on credit and stuff. You
most definitely.
Yeah. No, that's
it. It did start once. Just once. I remember getting my mother's, is it K's or Freeman's catalog? Just once. I did it just once. And I remember paying for maybe a year for these things, high tech texts or something
six
stupid.
Times over.
Yeah. But no, I stopped doing that. But,
if it brings you joy and you can justify it and you don't, it's fine. Everything in moderation. But it shouldn't be that, you know, I've got the latest trainers, I've got the latest phone, I've got this and that. And I've recently got a new phone and it's just like, because I had my old phone for like 6 years, it worked.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't need a new phone. You don't need to always have the latest things. There's more important things to spend money on.
And that supports, I think, it's something you're passionate about in terms of sustainability. You know, you don't have to keep on replacing your phones.
Yeah.
As we talk, my phone here is smashed.
Yeah.
I see myself like 1,000 times. But it's okay.
Yeah,
it's okay. I can have another one, but do I really need another one?
Yeah.
Nah. So what does the future hold for you, Paula? I would vote for you if you were MP, by the way. You'll get my vote.
Yeah.
You would get my vote. Your passion, your sincere lady there, you know, you're a grafter.
Yeah. And I think what's helped me in life is my family. So, you know, they've always brought me back down to earth. You know, if I ever did think I was getting a bit too, like, big for my boots, I'm like, no, they remind me who I am.
Are you the eldest? Are you the eldest?
I am the eldest. I've got a younger brother. Yeah.
Is he spoiled?
All the youngers. He's very spoiled.
That's fine.
A good thing.
And any message that you have for anybody out there that listen to this podcast that is thinking and got that urge, the itch that won't go anywhere about the fashion industry, and what message would you have for them?
Go for it. I mean, you know, you don't know until you try, and just try and do. And you know, you can be in an environment that might be slightly uncomfortable, but always be true to yourself.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes things will happen that I'm a bit like, oh, there, but always act professionally. And and you know, I just work hard, be prepared.
Yeah.
And
you heard it directly from the source. I could have said it myself and quoted it after, but I felt, no, it's better that Paula, Paula represents herself quite eloquently on that one herself. So no, Paula, it's been excellent.
Oh, you
know, I feel so, so blessed. And I'm sure you guys out there would be happy when you listen to this podcast and, you know, let inspire you, even if you're in the gym, on the treadmill, you know, burn off those calories, listen and replay, share with your friends. And fashion industry is not like how it was before.
No, not at all. There's room for all of us.
Oh my God. There's room for all of us. Have a great weekend. Have a great life, people. Paula, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
We out.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to check out micdropclub.com and get the show notes and useful links. Subscribe to the podcast. Don't just live life, make life boom.